Have you ever messed up or did something you weren't supposed to do, and then you just kind of waited in agony for that thing to come to light, for that phone call or that email or that confrontation, that conversation? So you're almost relieved when it does. And maybe you just couldn't take it and you confess it all by yourself. Let me ask you another question. Has somebody ever wronged you in such a way where it's almost ridiculous how wrong they are? So many times the situation is confusing. We don't know whether we can be mad, but I'm talking about those situations where we feel like we could have every right to go off the handle on somebody and no one would say a word. Now, let's say those two situations are really one situation. And that those two situations, or this one situation now, involves two people, the offender and the offended. Now, how would you come alongside those two people and help? What advice or counsel are you going to give? And now let's say you know the truth of the situation, you know what you're going to say. How are you going to communicate that? How are you going to say it? Enter the book of Philemon. Last week, we introduced the letter to Philemon and considered the crisis that is the context of this letter. Paul's in prison in Rome, and by God's providence, he meets a runaway slave named Onesimus, who comes to faith through Paul's preaching of the gospel. Onesimus can't run forever. And perhaps this is why he comes to Paul in the first place. He knows Paul is in Rome. He knows he has to face some music. Paul knows Philemon. So it just makes sense that he seeks out the one man who can help his situation, maybe convince Philemon. Or, and I think equally plausible, Onesimus never intended to return to Philemon. Never intended to run into Paul, but he runs into Paul, he gets saved, and now a life in agreement with the gospel means that he must face the music and make amends with his brother in the faith, Philemon. Either way, there are serious wrongs that need to be righted. And Onesimus's life is literally on the line. If Philemon decides to press charges, Onesimus would legally be put to death. The stakes are high. The stakes are high. And Paul's here to mediate this conflict and appeal to Philemon to receive back Onesimus. And maybe more. What's the foundation of this appeal? Last week, we identified that as the gospel, and we said the good news that God has extended grace at cost to himself to establish peace with sinners. That's the foundation of his appeal. The gospel is a paradigm for forgiveness. It's the foundation with our relationship with God, but also in the focus in this letter, the foundation of our relationship with others. It's the reason Philemon has peace with God. It's the reason why Paul's in prison. And it's the reason why Onesimus is on his way back to the man he wronged, who literally holds his life in his hands. So here's the outline of his appeal and of the letter to Philemon. I'll have it up here on the screen here. So last week, we introduced the letter and talked about his introduction, verse 1 through 3. It's Paul to Philemon, grace and peace. This week, we're going to cover verses 4 through 7. And Paul starts this appeal by praising Philemon. There's going to be two parts of that, a thanksgiving and a prayer. We're going to talk about that this evening. And then the bulk of this letter and his appeal is actually given to the appeal itself in verses 8 through 22. He's going to give some context to that, the background, the setting of that appeal, going to frame that in biblical perspective. He's going to get to his specific request in verse 17 with followed by some practical terms, and then ends that appeal with a hopeful and honoring expectation from Onesimus to his appeal, and he closes with a greeting and with a prayer. And this essentially is the summary of Philemon. that outline in this statement. Philemon, be the man that God has called you and I know you to be. It's essentially the letter. So let's look together starting in verse 4 with Paul the prisoner's praise of Philemon. And this is how we should understand these verses together, verses 4 through 7. So Paul's praising Philemon. He starts with a general thanksgiving and a report of prayer in verse 4. That's common for Paul to do. Then in verse 5, he's going to explain why he's thankful. In verse 6, he's going to give us the content of his prayers for Philemon. And in verse 7, he's going to summarize all that, all his praise and thanksgiving in a more personal way. So let's start in verse 4. I thank my God always when I remember you in my prayers. So firstly, and to state the obvious, Paul is praying for Philemon in his ministry. And here's kind of how it goes. He's praying, he remembers Philemon, and then he prays some more and in thankfulness for Philemon. And this is significant because Paul usually speaks this way about specific churches, not necessarily specific people. Paul isn't praying for each individual he's ever met by name, but what's more likely and significant in terms of the role Philemon plays in Colossae is that when Paul's praying for the church there, Philemon's name naturally comes up because of his leadership. And this is Paul's ministry, to plant, build, and pray for churches that he established. Paul states in 2 Corinthians 11:28, that apart from external trials, every physical thing that's happened and suffering that I've endured, there is the daily pressure on me of my anxiety, my deep concern for all the churches. So Paul's praying for Philemon isn't kind of like this polite Christian gesture like, I've been praying for you, or I'll be praying for you. But it's this weighty burden that he's daily taking to the Lord for the churches he's established. But why is Paul thankful when he prays for Philemon? Look at verse 5. Because I hear of your love and of the faith that you have towards the Lord Jesus and for all the saints. Pause. How do you have love and faith towards the Lord Jesus and specifically for all the saints? It's confusing. And what specifically did Paul hear to come to that conclusion? Because I think we understand love pretty clearly in this sentence, right? I hear of your love that you have for the Lord and for all the saints. Perfect sentence. I think it's also clear if we just apply the word faith here towards the Lord. I hear of the love and faith you have towards the Lord and the love that you have for all the saints. But what does it mean to have faith towards all the saints? Typically, when we think about faith, we think about faith verbal. And we might go a step further and think about faith visceral or internal, deep within us. But in these verses, Paul is thinking about faith visible, and we might say faithfulness. So when Paul says he hears about Philemon's faith towards the Lord and towards all the saints, he's commending his Christian conduct and his conviction in private and in public, in community. So what sort of things did Paul hear about Philemon to come to this conclusion? And only one thing for sure, that he was at least hospitable enough to host a portion of the church in his house. And a lot of people remark on Philemon's generosity. And the New Testament connects those things. And I think we should assume those things of Philemon as well, rightly so. 1 John 1:3 says this, by this we know love. That he, being Christ, laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. And Philemon is a man who loves indeed and truth, and Paul's actually counting on that. So to put it all together now, Paul has heard reports about Philemon's sincere love for the Lord and for all his people, his faith in the Lord, and how that faith is displayed and lived with the people of God. It's faith in action. which is immediately tied into the next verse in the overall appeal of Philemon. Paul's going to ask Philemon specifically to live out his faith as it relates to Onesimus. So what is Paul praying for Philemon? He's got a report of prayer. He's remembering Philemon, and he says, hey, and here's what I'm praying for you. When I remember you and express thankfulness, here's my prayer for you, and here's what I'm going to continue to pray for you. In verse 6, and I pray that the sharing of your faith may become effective for the full knowledge of every good thing that is in us for the sake of Christ. This is the most difficult passage in Philemon here, because we have to define the different elements of the verse to really understand the whole. And I see four different elements. First, we need to determine, what does Paul mean by the sharing of your faith? What does Paul mean that it might become effective? That's a weird word in biblical terms. And then, what's it mean for the full knowledge of every good thing that is in us or among us? And then fourthly, for the sake of Christ. So let's start with sharing your faith. Other versions might say fellowship of your faith, which sounds more biblical, but I like the ESV's choice here when it says sharing. But again, when we hear sharing of your faith, we naturally immediately think about evangelism. Paul's praying for his evangelistic efforts, because we're thinking about verbal faith. But this is the sharing of Philemon's visible faith. And we know that it's Philemon's faith in question, because the "your" here is singular as opposed to "y'all" or "y'all's faith." And we also know the sharing of this faith is within the community of believers, because it's, the verse says so, among us, in us, at the latter half of the verse. Okay, so the object of Paul's prayer is the sharing of Philemon's faith, or the interaction of Philemon's faith within the community of faith. But what is Paul praying about it or for it? And this is the second element, that it may become effective. Effective is an interesting word here. It's only used two other times in the New Testament, and you've probably heard it in this famous verse. You ready? For the word of God is living and active, or effective, sharper than any two-edged sword. And the Greek word is spelled almost identical to our word, and where we get our word, for energy. The idea is that it's able to effect change. It's able to impact, to be working, to be filled with energy. What do we do with kids that are filled with energy? We send them with grandparents, right? Send them to grandparents. No, but when grandparents aren't available, we put them to work. We send them outside to play. We got to get all that energy out before bedtime rolls around. And the focus here is on the outworking of that energy, or we might say active or working or effective. Think about the opposite. This is helpful to understand the original. Think about the opposite. What is Paul praying against? He doesn't want the interaction of Philemon's faith among the church to be ineffective, to be stagnant, to be lazy, inactive, lifeless. Paul's saying, Philemon, I don't want to see your faith on unemployment. When the sun comes up, I want to see you roll up your sleeves, knees in the breeze, and get to work. To paraphrase the book of James, if your faith doesn't work, your faith isn't working. So Paul prays that the sharing of Philemon's faith may be effective, ready to work, powerful, affecting change. But what exactly does Paul have in mind? If the sharing of Philemon's faith is the object of his prayer, and effectiveness is the goal, what is the means by which that goal will be accomplished? The third element, for or through the knowledge of every good thing which is in us or among us. And this knowledge here probably isn't just simply an awareness of every good thing, but an experiential knowledge, the actual doing of every good thing and the knowledge that comes along with that. And every good thing here is purposely open-ended. It sounds oddly familiar to Philippians 4. Tell me if you've heard this before. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, Whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. Paul isn't short-sighted here. He doesn't just want Philemon to answer his specific request. He's got bigger goals than that and just this conflict. And he wants Philemon to see past that as well. Last week I said, and it came with hand movements, good biblical peacemakers help people see past positions and problems to consider biblical perspectives, prioritize relationships, and pursue godly goals. What's Paul doing here? He doesn't start with addressing the conflict. He starts by praising Philemon, valuing him, prioritizing the relationship that they have, and framing all this within the biblical perspective of grace and peace. And now he's outlining this goal. Not just reconciliation with Onesimus and job well done. No, we have to think bigger than that, Philemon. We want the sharing of our faith among the brethren to be effective through the knowledge of every good thing among us, not just this one request. Paul's praying for the outworking of Philemon's faith in every facet, situation, relationship, crook, and cranny of his life. It's almost as he's asking Philemon to meditate on the endless ways that he can live out the gospel. But why? Why? Why should Philemon do this? What's Philemon's motivation in all this? For Paul's sake? Come on, Phil. Just do me this one favor for old time's sake. You owe me one. Is it for Onesimus' sake? I mean, look at him. His life would be so much better, so much improved if you just help him out. He's pitiful. Is it for Philemon's sake? Philemon, you've got such a great reputation. It would be a shame for this to hurt that. Plus, you'd be seen as a great guy, Philemon the generous. But what does the text say? For Christ's sake. Philemon, I want your faith to be effective. Not because it would appease me or make me happy. Not because Onesimus is really in a bind. And definitely not because I think it'll make you feel better as a person. We love because he first loved us. Do it for Christ's sake, for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of the kingdom and the mission here on earth. Don't you see how different a dynamic that is? Do it as an act of worship to God. And church, if you're coming to conflict, focusing on your rights and your freedoms and not the gospel and its mission, you've got the cart before the horse. Conflict is way more about God than its problems and people. And I know we could say that about anything, but it applies here too. How you respond to conflict reveals what you think about God. That's worth meditating on. Paul's prayer for Philemon is that his faith would be working out all the implications of the gospel, and ultimately with this conflict in mind. And I want to build on this idea of handling conflict for Christ's sake, or conflict coram Deo, responding to God as a response to conflict. It's the title of this message anyways. In this upcoming week, I've got bad news for you. You're going to be in a conflict. It's not an if, it's a when. And if you're married, you're going to butt heads with your spouse this week. Because you're two sinners under one roof, 24/7, 365. How are you going to respond? How are you going to think through that, process that? And what are you going to say about God and how you do that? Well, let's start with the source of conflict and what that says about God, namely that he isn't. He isn't God. Something else is God. Listen to James put his finger on the source of conflict in James 4. He's so helpful here, so direct. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? What a layup. Thanks, James. Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. In 90% of our conflicts, desires and idolatry are the culprit. And honestly, I think I'm being generous. I'd say that less than 10% of our conflicts are maybe legitimate or over something serious. Have you ever wondered why the most insignificant things turn into the most heated arguments and conflicts? Isn't that true? Before Tracy and I got married, we went through a book called Peacemaking for Families. It's by Ken Sandy, and honestly, outside the Bible, no other book has been more instrumental in our marriage. In fact, I think it's been the most repeated book purchase that we have in our house because we've given it out so many times. In the beginning of the book, Sandy helps us think through this question. How does an idol become an idol? How does an idol become an idol? And he's thinking in the context of conflict in the passage we just read in James 4. He summarizes this process with four statements, or what he calls progressions, under the heading, progression of an idol. How desires progress towards idolatry. Here they are. I desire, I demand, I judge, I punish. I desire, I demand, I judge, I punish. A desire can be good or bad, morally neutral. And let's take this classic example, sorry, bear with me, of a man who comes home from work. And his desire might be for a clean house, warm dinner, a little R&R, some me time. At this point, it's simply a desire. And it's perfectly possible that when he gets home and realizes that none of his desires have been filled, maybe he's upset, disappointed, but otherwise nonchalant, and maybe he even pitches in to help. Guys, however, when he arrives home and he's wondering why these desires haven't been fulfilled and then expresses a negative moral judgment against this perceived evil, that desire has turned into a demand or an idol that must be appeased. It's no longer an undeserved blessing or a it'd be nice if, it's a ought, a should, a must, an expectation. And then he starts to judge the motives of his wife. I judge. What's she been doing all day? Doesn't she know that I've been at work all day and I just want to come home and relax? She's so thoughtless. Why doesn't she love me? Is she doing this on purpose? She's got it so easy. This is so wrong. So you started with the desire that maybe was neither good nor bad, that it'd be nice if. It turned into an expectation that you demanded, and when that demand wasn't met, you judged that person as having done some evil because you're definitely qualified for that position. And now with a guilty verdict in hand, you must pass down your sentence. How's this wife going to pay for her crimes? Either with revealing or concealing manifestations of anger. Again, this is Sandy giving us clarity here. With revealing, maybe snarky comments, critiques, verbal, physical abuse, or even worse, or if you're like me, more concealing. Little sarcasm here. Or give him the old silent treatment. Or maybe just get up and leave. And the awareness of this paradigm alone has been so helpful in our marriage to just help us pause and reflect at the start of a conflict. Why am I angry? Is this person actually doing something wrong? Or do I have an expectation that hasn't been met? That's so important to distinguish. And how we respond to conflict communicates what we say about God. Think back to the paradigm. This thing that I desire, is it godly or ungodly? Or is it morally neutral? Am I elevating this desire to a level that the Bible doesn't? Is it something that the Bible demands? Am I really qualified to judge the motives of other people? Does my judgment against this person agree with God's judgment against this person? Do I know everything that God knows? Is it my place to punish this person? Who's the lawgiver and judge? Who takes vengeance? What's my responsibility to an offense? Our responses are not the results of other people's actions. Let me say it louder for the people in the back. We are not passive machines reacting to circumstances and the actions of others. That's dehumanizing. As divine image bearers, we are active moral responders accountable to God, and we're called to respond to God as a response to conflict. I'm going to speak more on that as we go through Philemon, but for now, let's close with verse 7. For I have derived much joy and comfort from your love, my brother, because the hearts of the saints have been refreshed through you. A couple notes here. First, the idea of comfort is literally a walking alongside of. Probably better fits here with translations that say encouragement. Comforts usually have a connotation of suffering, hardship. Encouragement is more the idea here. And I think that's supported by the idea that this love that Paul's encouraged by is not for Paul, but for the saints, as stated in the verse. Paul was probably comforted by Philemon's love, but here it's the overall idea is that Paul was encouraged by his love for others. And secondly, we have to talk about this word refresh, especially tonight with this heat. It has been crazy hot and humid out here lately. And last week, I was delivering out in this neighborhood, and I couldn't believe my eyes. There, on the side of the street, straight out of a Norman Rockwell painting, table, two chairs, some cups, and a cardboard sign that read, "Lemonade, 25 cents. What a deal." And to be honest, that was the best cup of lemonade I'd ever had in my life. That's what Philemon's love was to the church. If you think about that word refresh, it literally means to make fresh once again. And this is the same word that Jesus used when he said, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest." Refreshment, a pause from your labors to gain your strength. Rest and refreshment implies some sort of depletion and exhaustion. And Philemon's love was a source of strength for the church amidst trials, burdens, and crises. This is why we share our faith together in this thing we call church. It's part of the design. The author of Hebrews puts it this way: "And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as the habit is of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near." That's why you're here tonight. Did you know that? We came here tonight to be mutually refreshed by the sharing of our faith. This thing called life is not a one-player game. You can't live out your faith by yourself. Love is not an island. And the enemy wants you to be exhausted. He wants you to be tired. He wants you to be run down all the time. And we all have those days, don't we? We don't want to go anywhere. We don't want to do anything. And those days happen on Sunday too. But what if I told you that it was Satan's game plan and is his game plan since the garden to get you alone so that he can lie to you and so that you can lie to yourself? We need each other because we're so prone to discouragement, to deceitfulness, to exhaustion. The author of Hebrews helps us once again. But exhort one another, encourage one another every day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. We need refreshment. We need the rest that comes by our mutual fellowship. And I wonder how others would describe our love. Would they say it's refreshing, like that cup of lemonade, that patch of shade, that breeze in the heat, or something else? Do you want to be a refreshment to all the saints? Pray for them. Have them over for dinner. Encourage them directly. Ask them how their week's going. Bear their burdens at cost to yourself. Help them financially. Counsel them in the word. Just listen to them. Do you not want to do that? Then just come to church, sit in that pew, have some passing polite conversation, go home, rinse, wash, repeat. You will neither be refreshed or be refreshing. But, brothers and sisters, my heart is refreshed by you here at Cosmosdale. So keep it up. Let's strive and pray that as we walk together in faith, that we meditate on and work out the gospel through the knowledge of every good thing that is among us for Christ's sake. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God.